The writer Nora Ephron said, "When your children are teenagers, it's important to have a dog so that someone in the house is happy to see you." Welcome to the Mumifesto. I'm Stella Creasy, the Labour and Cooperative MP for Walthamstow, a mum of two young children. My guest this week is the incredible campaigner, author, and frankly one of my mates, Jolie Brearley. She set up Pregnant Then Screwed in 2015 after her own experience of pregnancy discrimination. Pregnant Then Screwed is now a charity dedicated to ending the motherhood penalty and supports thousands of women each year through the vagaries of pregnancy and maternity discrimination. Alongside her campaign work, Jolie's also an author, an Amnesty International human rights defender, and a member of the United Nations Working Group on Women's Rights in the Changing World of Work. Welcome to the Mumifesto, Jolie. Jolie Brearley, welcome to the Mumifesto. The first question I have to ask is, how did the genius that is Jolie Brearley and all the brilliance of Pregnant Then Screwed arrive and appear in our lives to do such brilliant things? Tell us your origin story, Jolie.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It is lovely to be here. What a lovely introduction as well. I mean, I'm not sure genius is the right word. Probably sort of.
Don't make me come and find you and have to beat you up for putting yourself down. You are a living legend. And frankly, if you're not in the House of Lords soon, well, I'm going to be very cross.
I'm not sure how Pregnant Then Screwed works, but
Baroness, surely. Baroness.
Baroness Pregnant Then Screwed. I do like that. I mean, I do get a kick every time the name Pregnant Then Screwed is said in Parliament. It always feels really good to hear politicians say screwed really loudly around the House of Commons.
I know, you're like the permissible Davina McCall. Like when in our voices, when we get up to speak, it says, please do not swear, except for Jolie Brearley.
I have seen when people say Pregnant Then Screwed, them say Pregnant Then Screwed. So how did I come into your lives? Well, I had a really awful time. I was working for a children's charity in the northeast of England, found out I was pregnant, wasn't planned, but that's a whole other story, and told them that I was due to have a baby, and the next day they sacked me by voicemail.
Oh, so 1990s!
I mean, I honestly had no idea that that really happened. I genuinely thought I was the only person that had experienced something like that. And I mean, it was a children's charity that pushed me out. So, you know, it goes to show how common it is across different industries. And so I tried to do something about it. I got a lawyer. The lawyer wrote them a letter. The charity threw the letter in the bin. That process cost me £350, and I had no idea where my next income was coming from. So that was terrifying. And then I said to the lawyers, well, what next? And they said, well, you can take them to tribunal. I said, how much would that cost? And they said, well, it'd be about, you know, £9,000. And who has, I don't have £9,000 sloshing around in my bank account. I usually have minus something in my bank account. So I said to them, okay, I'll think about it. So you only have 3 months, you know this well, you only have 3 months less one day to raise a tribunal claim from the point the discrimination occurs. So I couldn't wait until the baby was born and then start the legal proceedings. And I was literally left with the very stark choice of accessing the justice I deserved or protecting the health of my unborn child. And that was it. I found myself lying on a sofa, watching daytime telly, or thinking, where's my life gone? I've lost everything overnight. I've lost my income. I don't think my baby's going to survive. And I felt worthless. I just felt I had nothing.
A lot of us watch daytime TV, Jolie. Not all of us have been inspired to create something as magical as Pregnant Then Screwed. Just tell us about the process of setting up Pregnant Then Screwed.
So I after I had my son, who is a very healthy 10-year-old now, I started going to parent groups, as you do, you know, all the baby yoga and the like things in the park to drink cups of tea. I met lots of other mums, and the majority of them had stories. Something had happened to them at work from the point that they got pregnant. And it really opened my eyes to the fact that it wasn't just me. This actually was a thing. It was happening a lot. But I didn't know about it. So I thought, well, if I didn't know that this was a problem and this was happening, then surely other people don't. So the first thing I did, it was one morning I woke up, it was International Women's Day, and I thought, right, I'm going to do something about it today.
You thought, it's Lady Christmas, I've got to give myself a present.
I've got to, yeah, exactly, a lady present. So I woke up that morning and I taught myself how to use WordPress whilst bouncing my son on my knee and like trying to spoon feed him porridge. And I'd already thought the name, Pregnant Then Screwed, it was going to be worse than that to begin with because I was so cross. I think you can imagine Pregnant Then. You know? And but I thought, you know, we'll just tone it down.
We're not going to judge because the best pun we could come up with was Mama Festo. So
it's pretty good. I think that's great. You know, a good pun goes a long way, Stella. So I launched this website in the afternoon. It was very basic and I put my story on it and a good friend's story on it and then started pushing it out through Twitter. And then by the end of the day, it had 5,000 views, the website, and I thought, blimey, this has got a bit of attention already. So I started asking other people to put their stories on, but people were so scared of posting the stories, even though it was anonymous, because of course the majority of people sign a non-disclosure agreement. Right. This happens to them. They're silenced and gagged by their employer. And so if they say anything about what happened to them, then they can be taken straight off to court and have to pay all of any money back that they've had. And it, you know, it's a brutal, horrible process. So it took a while for me to convince people to put their stories up. And then it sort of mushroomed from there. I went on the Victoria Derbyshire show and then got loads of stories through. But as these stories were coming through, people were saying, please, can you help me? I don't know what to do. They were in the middle of having a really difficult time. And of course, I'm not an employment lawyer. So I eventually found an employment lawyer in Manchester where I was living at the time called Danielle Ayres, who's brilliant. And we went for a cup of tea and I asked her if she'd help me and she said yes. So initially she was just doing like 3 calls from the bath on a night. And she is still involved. And last year we supported through that same advice line over 8,000 women. So she's not doing them from the bath anymore.
I know that is a very, very wrinkly lawyer if she's still sat in the bath.
And cold, very cold.
One solitary rubber duck floated past, so no, you do have rights, but it is expensive.
she's still involved. She's so brilliant. And then we set up a mentor program. So we started supporting women who were going through an employment tribunal because that's really onerous and brutal. And then we've set up like a work coaching program and a mental health support program. And then, you know, alongside that, we were thinking, well, this is dealing with the symptoms of the problem, but we need to deal with the cause. We need to deal with what's actually the underlying issues. And so we started campaigning. And the first campaign that we did was the 3-month time limit, because that's partly what had scuppered me. And we do now have a commitment from Labour that that time limit will be extended. We've been campaigning on that for 9 years. And then slowly we started building other campaigns and here we are. We're now a charity, fully functioning charity. There'll soon be 12 of us.
Wow.
We last year we supported over 90,000 women with free legal advice and support, and we've done massive campaigns and protests and won lots of awards.
Been to some very good dinners, I suspect, because you've won all these brilliant awards. Just talk us through a bit about some of the campaigns. I mean, obviously you talked there about non-disclosure agreements. They're really toxic to our understanding of quite the level of pregnancy discrimination that women face. Tell us a bit more about them.
Yeah, I mean, they're gagging clauses. So what tends to happen, there are sort of two experiences of non-disclosure agreements. So either somebody is, so that the woman is pregnant, something happens to her, and often it can be quite extreme. So they can be demoted, or they can be told they may be made redundant, or they can be, you know, literally pushed out of their job. And when they're sort of on their knees, broken, the employer will say to them, "Tell you what, here's £3,000 and a good reference, but just sign this document so that you can never speak about it again. And it's over, it's done. You can leave with £3,000. And of course, they do, because there's no other real option. Because when you're pregnant, the notion of taking legal action against an employer is just, it's too much. It's far too much. So you do, you just do it. But the problem is, further down the line, they realize that they are now, they can't ever speak about what happened to them again. And it's like a dirty secret, like they're holding this trauma. They really hold all the trauma of what's happened to them. And even when they go for interviews at other employers, they can't talk about what happened. They can't talk about it to their colleagues, who, of course, are friends. And we know that it really damages their mental health. And the other way they're used is when employees do decide they're going to go for it and take legal action, the employer will often wear them down. So they will try and string it out for as long as possible. They will threaten them by saying they're going to go after them for costs. And they will just do everything in their power to make it really, really difficult. And then just before the tribunal, they'll say, "Here you go. Here's a lot more money, but you've got to sign this non-disclosure agreement." And of course, again, they take it because often it's more money they would than they would ever win at tribunal. But the employer leaves it right to the last minute when they know they've got no choice but to shut them up. So this is why we don't really know what's happening, because they're used so cleverly by employers, and they're you know, just these legal silencing tools that we currently can't really do anything about.
But one other area where we do know what's happening, where also you guys have had a massive impact, is, of course, on the debate around childcare. Now, when I first met you, childcare definitely was a lady issue. It was definitely something that it was like, we need to give women some more hours so they can go to those baby yoga classes. I have to be honest, like, baby yoga made my blood run cold. I couldn't do yoga as an adult. Why would I try and make a kid do it? But talk to us a bit about the campaign on childcare and just how things have moved, because I think that is directly responsible. I think, Jodie, you are frankly responsible for getting it on the political agenda in a way that many of us have failed for years. So it's really fascinating to hear how you managed to do that. How much persistence it involved.
Well, I mean, that is very kind. There are a lot of people that have really changed the dial on childcare. It's been amazing to watch different groups and different organisations get behind it. But as you know, Stella, you know, 5 years ago, you talk about childcare to most MPs and they'd look at you like you had two chocolate fingers stuck up your nose, like you completely lost your mind. Why?
Oh, that was just me who did that, Jolie.
You stuck two chocolate fingers up your nose. Kids would do that happily for hours. There was just no interest in it. And it was, you know, as if, like, why would we care about that? That's a mum's issue and they can just sort that out. And so the sea change has been really significant, obviously. And the way that I think it changed is by coupling this issue with the economy, by showing and demonstrating that if you invest in childcare, you invest in the economy, and that you reap more back into the economy because you have a functioning childcare system. And we did that through data, through stories, through showing all these brilliant, brilliant women that can contribute so much to the UK, who want to work desperately but can't because we haven't got a functioning childcare system. And I think March of the Mummies was pretty significant. It did make a big difference because prior to that, yes, the press had started covering it a lot. Yes, we had data to support it. Yes, we had the economic argument. But when you could visually see 15,000 people out on the streets shouting for better systems, for better childcare systems, it just showed how strong the feeling was amongst parents. I mean, getting parents out of the house to do anything is really difficult, because as you know full well, you try and leave the house and suddenly your kid poos themselves or throws up or starts screaming, or you know,
so just one shoe, at least not both shoes, just one shoe.
So they
can't give up on the shoes because you know it's somewhere here. Yeah. How did you feel during the pandemic? Because I think that was also a seminal moment where suddenly there was a lot of public interest in kind of infrastructure and roads and, you know, what we were going to do to build back better. But parents are being given a pat on the back for looking after their kids at home. And that felt like a real changing moment in our understanding of where childcare and support for people mattered.
Yeah, it was sort of the Icelandic women's strike on a different scale, wasn't it? Because you did suddenly see these predominantly women trapped at home with their kids who then couldn't do their jobs, because, of course, you can't look after a child. Looking after a child is work. It's a full-time job in and of itself. And so you suddenly realise you couldn't do both. We set up a line during the pandemic, a phone line for women who were trapped in their house that were struggling and felt completely ignored. And the calls we got were absolutely devastating. Women, like, on the verge, they were really on the verge of, you know, falling apart. And in the end, we had to close the line because we felt like they were so traumatic, these calls, and we weren't giving them anything that would help them with their trauma. And we obviously then felt responsible. We've kept some of the recordings, and sometimes I do play it at events to show how bad things really got, because I think we can forget. But that, and you in particular, really flew the flag for the fact that childcare is infrastructure, that we could now show that direct link between women in the workplace and a functioning childcare system. And of course, we didn't have a functioning childcare system at all during the pandemic. We didn't have functioning lots of things during the pandemic. But I do think that really, it helped. The positive we can draw from the pandemic is that it did put childcare on the map.
I think it was a very surreal moment when suddenly actually a lot of women said, no, we're not going to take this. I mean, to my mind particularly, I think it would still come out in the COVID inquiry. That came about when we talked about pregnant women during the pandemic and the fact that they were just not being thought about at all when it came to the vaccine or planning for healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I have never seen anything like it, where actually rather than people kind of going, oh, yeah, fair enough. I mean, you know, these are lady things, and lady things come after important economic things. So suddenly I'm like, no, actually, you need to take us seriously. What did that mean for you as an organisation? What was the, you sort of talk about the phone line, but in terms of growing and in terms of, you know, becoming what you've become now, that moment of actually, we're not going to take this anymore.
The pandemic was pivotal for us because what we do as an organisation is connect with parents, particularly mothers. They trust us. They feel that we're their mates, that they can talk to us, they can tell us what's going on and that we'll help them. So when the pandemic happened, everything was happening behind closed doors and politicians didn't know the experiences of parents, but they were coming to us and they were saying, this is what's happening to us. And we were then able to feed that back out to the press and to MPs to say, this is what your policies are doing on the ground. So with pregnant women, that moment that Boris Johnson made that statement, you must stay at home. And we had heard from, we'd heard that pregnant women should be really careful because they didn't know how COVID would impact them. There was no information available about how pregnant women keep themselves safe. There was no risk assessments. There was no, in this situation, if you are working and you're working outside of the home, this is what you should do as a pregnant woman. That advice took 9 months. It took 9 months before we got
that. As long as it takes to have a baby.
Exactly. Like the irony that it takes the same amount of time to have a baby. And we were doing everything we could to try and keep pregnant women safe. And we were asking Matt Hancock to put out a statement to say pregnant women should stay at home. They shouldn't be out working if it's dangerous, where they can contract COVID. And it was ignored. It was ignored. And then Mary Adjiapong, a nurse in Luton, who was pregnant, tragically died. She was the first pregnant woman to die. Her daughter survived. And then one after the other, the news kept coming of pregnant women who were dying because of COVID. And it was, I couldn't say Mary's name for a really long time because it hit so hard. And obviously it's not about us, it's about them. But the fact that this was just being ignored and not taken seriously, and this news kept coming and kept coming of these pregnant women that had died, it was hard. That was a really difficult period. Because we were translating policies into, we were there to act as the interim between policies and reality on the ground, we were able to push for changes. So things like the two-child limit, the rule where only two people could meet outside initially included children. And then, of course, if you had a baby, you couldn't just go, all right, see you later, I'm off to meet my mate. You just figure yourself out. So it meant new mums were really isolated, really alone. And thankfully, we managed to get that changed so that under fives were excluded from that. And then childcare bubbles, of course, because, you couldn't work again without childcare bubbles. So, again, we were really pushing for childcare bubbles. And finally, childcare bubbles came into place. So I think it was a moment where we realised how special it was what we'd built, because we were, people were coming to us and telling us what was going on and we could translate that out. But also people externally realised how important our work was. So that's when we started to grow and we started to get investment and funding.
Yeah. You've talked there a lot about working with mums, but I know you've also been doing quite a lot with dads and also the important about paternity leave and why actually, if we're going to help people who are pregnant and screwed, we also need to help the other side of the equation too. Just tell us a bit about that work as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's often forgotten about in these conversations that actually if we give, the way that you create equality is by having equality at work and at home. The two have to match. And what we have at the moment is a system whereby a woman has a baby and the dad or second parent is almost immediately shoved back to work. 2 weeks paternity leave is crap. We have the least generous paternity benefit in Europe in terms of the amount of money and the amount of time. So dads and second parents are just essentially told, oh, there you go, you've done your job, 2 weeks, you made him a cup of tea, right, off you go, you go back to work because that's where you belong. And the mum stays at home and does all of that hard, really exhausting work of raising a baby.
Well, the mum has that kind of two-week panic moment where the door closes and you're on your own with the baby and you think, please don't break.
Oh, leave me alone. Oh, I mean, I remember after I'd had my second and my partner went back to work and somebody said to me, it was the best advice I'd ever been given. They said, as long as you don't lose one or end up in A&E, you're winning. That's all you need to care about.
At the end of the day, if there are still two children in the house, it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they're not dead. Then yeah. Great, brilliant. But by the time a woman thinks about returning to work, she's firmly in that position of main caregiver. She's responsible for that child because she has taken usually around 9 months off work and has done all of that learning of how to look after them, how they like the toast cut, how to get them to sleep, all of the stuff that you learn on the job. And the second parent or the dad hasn't got that knowledge. They don't really know what they're doing. So they just stay as a, as in the background. They're the support act, and the mum is the main carer. And so she makes these really difficult decisions when she's returning about asking for to go part-time because, of course, you need to be able to pick your kids up and do all of the unpaid labour at home. She compares her salary to childcare costs, and, of course, often it doesn't make sense. And so the woman then tends to take a step back in her career as a result because she is making all of these sacrifices. So her earnings start to dip and they never really recover, whereas men's earnings tend to remain the same and then start to increase.
Jolie, don't tell anybody about the motherhood penalty because it's the bogeyman. It doesn't really exist, does it?
No, apparently
what you just described is the motherhood penalty. But as we both know from the Twitter sphere, we should just be grateful all the time.
I know. I mean, how dare we say anything negative about having a child? And I think people get really confused when you say the motherhood penalty and think you're saying that motherhood itself is a penalty, rather than actually investigating and researching what the term means. And actually what it does mean is the systematic and systemic disadvantages that mothers encounter in terms of pay, perceived competence and benefits compared to their childless counterparts. It's the gender pay gap. 80% of the gender pay gap is the motherhood penalty. And the motherhood
penalty... In plain terms, what we mean is, like, you have a baby and people think, oh, well, that's you done then. Because I know it's you or the baby. So if you're going to be back in the workplace, you can't think about the baby. And if you don't think about the baby, you're a terrible mum. And if you do want to play with the baby a bit, then you're probably not committed to the job. So you're a terrible employee. So which is a winning proposition in this?
Exactly. Well, there's loads of research that shows that women are seen as distracted and less committed to their job from the point that they get pregnant. And there's research to show that if you take your full maternity leave and you return to work, you're seen as though you can't be bothered to do your job. If you return to work early and don't take your full maternity leave, then you're seen as not caring and not loving and a total cold fish. You cannot win. Whereas men are seen as more dedicated to their jobs and more deserving of pay rises and promotions once they have kids, because, of course, they are now the breadwinner and they are responsible for a family. So, therefore, they're going to be committed.
I often think they do walk on water at that point, because obviously they are doing amazing things, you know, just by looking after a baby for an hour. That's why I found in Parliament the kind of daddy daycare argument used to really make me grit my teeth. Because the irony is, actually, I think there's a lot of men who feel they don't get time with their kids, which is why the stuff you're doing on paternity leave is so important. Like you say, they become a support act. They don't get the opportunity to build that bond. And then they end up later in life saying, I wasn't as close to my kids because I was working all the time. So nobody's winning in that scenario, except on the Twitter sphere, because as a man, if you've looked after a baby for a whole hour, you are basically a saint.
Yeah, well, I mean... What's really sad about it is that there was somebody who recorded what people tend to say on their deathbeds most often. And men are really likely to say, I wish I hadn't worked so much. I wish I'd spent more time with my kids. And so we know dads are desperate to spend more time with their children. The majority say they'd do anything to spend more time with their kids. So this isn't about feckless lay about dads. This is about a system that tells them to sling the hook, get back to work, and women to do all of the care work. And actually, if we were sharing that care work effectively and sharing the paid work effectively, we'd all be loads happier. Couples are much more likely to stay together. If dads spend time with their kids in the early days, couples are 40% more likely to stay together. So it's good for everybody. And the work we've done has shown it's really good for the economy. So countries that have at least 6 weeks paternity leave paid at a good percentage of salary have a 4% smaller gender pay gap. That's significant. That's a big reduction to the gender pay gap. And they have a smaller labour force participation gap, i.e. you've got more women in work and more women working longer hours. So
just like childcare, obviously investing in families actually pays off for the economy.
Yeah.
But I've got to ask you, because obviously childcare is now a big hot political topic, where do you think we're at right now with childcare in the UK?
So when the £4 billion investment was announced by the Chancellor in March 2022, I was elated. And, you know, I was elated because that is a significant investment and a significant move towards a better childcare system. The problem is that there was no consultation with the sector about how that $4 billion should be used effectively. And we're in a situation now where the new funded places have started being rolled out, but the experiences by parents vary dramatically. So some parents are saving nothing at all from these new funded programs. Others are saving, you know, up to about £350 a month. But you have areas of deprivation where there are no childcare facilities at all. So you've got children who would benefit the most from a really high quality functioning childcare system, and their parents would benefit a lot, where there just isn't the provision because the way the funding works, it's not encouraging childcare settings to survive in areas of deprivation. So we've just got such a polarization in experience. And what we really need is to scrap the whole system that we've got at the moment, because it's just been bolting on different. Oh, well, I've got an idea. Quick, let's throw that on there. To the point where we've got 8 different benefit systems. Nobody can understand it. The providers aren't being paid properly. The staff are leaving in droves. And parents aren't.
Every parent fears that moment where the email reminding them to re-sign up for their child tax-free credit, like goes to their spam filter and they miss it. And then they go back to the start again. And you're like, no! Again, all the things we had to fill in, all the forms and starting again. No,
it's the most clunky system as well to be able to apply for it, and loads of people just don't because they can't figure it out.
Yeah.
So although the investment is great, the commitment and ambition is great, the rollout is questionable. To put it mildly, the rollout is questionable. It's what we're looking at happening in September, where you'd be able to access 15 hours of funded childcare from the age of 9 months old, there will inevitably be lots of children that are going to miss out, that aren't going to be able to access that funding. And there is no plan to increase the number of staff and increase providers that is working at the moment. So
I think there's just also some basic things about it that are driving me loopy, which is every parent, unless you've got a 2-year-old right now, is paying more for childcare because it isn't quite right how the system's been put together. The only way the nurseries can make ends meet is to hike the fees. So if you've got a 2-year-old and I've got a 2-year-old, great, it does make a bit of a difference. It doesn't make as much of a difference as I think all of us were praying for, because obviously childcare is a massive cost. If you've got a child of any other age, your bill has just gone up. And my worry as a politician is if we see people doing the calculations, like you say, leaving the workforce before we've had a chance to show why investing in childcare actually makes a difference to the economy, then all those naysayers who say, look, this is just about giving women the chance to go to baby yoga, will say, see, and we'll have lost that moment where actually childcare is part of our economic infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. There are some grand statements coming out at the moment that this is increasing maternal employment, but there's no evidence at the moment that that's the case. And actually what our research is finding is that the average saving for parents is between £100 and £120 a month, which is not going to make the difference when childcare costs £14,000 a year on average. You know, the difference is about £1,000 it's going to make a month.
You've got a lot of campaigning things that we still need you to sort out, Jolie, and I'm going to ask you to which would be the priority and how people listening this can help. But before I do, like, the range of issues you've covered so far, what do your family make of all of this? Because when they saw you on the sofa watching Holmes and the Hammer, do you think they ever thought it'd get to this level where you were basically calling in the Chancellor and going, nah, need to do better, mate. What are we going to do next?
I think my family are a bit bored of it all, to be honest. I think that my kids love the name Pregnant Then Screwed, but my youngest son used to march around the house going, pregnant then screwed to himself. They are, I think.
Is that because it allows him to swear and you can't stop him?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, any opportunity to say anything rude.
I've noticed my children starting to repeat my words with total horror. I feel like there is no Instagram video I can find about how to fix that moment of bad parenting. And yet, at least if they were saying pregnant then screwed, there'd be some meaning to it. That's not the word they're using. They're using your original word.
Yeah. Well, same here. Yeah. Or they try and like slightly change one of the vowels to see with it. So, I mean, I think they are proud, but they, you know, it takes a lot. To the camp, you know very well, to always be on. You're always on when it's campaigning like this, because you don't feel like you can let people down once you've made a commitment to people. And the stuff that we deal with is trauma. Often it's pregnancy, maternity discrimination, it's people going through serious trauma. So you are always on. So I think there are highs and lows in that my kids will go, "Will you get off your phone?" Or, "Are you actually listening to me?" But at the same time, you know, they came to March of the Mummies and saw 15,000 people come out of the house and me stand on stage and talk and people cheer along and show their frustration and anger. So, you know, I also hope that they're proud too.
I bet they are proud. This podcast is obviously called the Mummifesto though. So I'm going to push you. What do you want to see on the agenda? What can people listening to this, what do you want them raising with their MP to make sure it's part of the general election that we're going to have in the next couple of months in this country?
Our top requests are, we want 60.
Hey, come on, it's like Sophie's Choice, Jolie. You've got to pick your favourite campaign.
How many am I allowed?
Because it's you and you are a national treasurer, I will allow you to.
Thanks, because I'm a national treasure.
I mean, basically, you are the new Babs Windsor to me. So, like, you're either going to appear in EastEnders as a character or you're going to be in the House of Lords. Either way, you are iconic. Which are you two?
I'm 6 weeks paternity leave at 90% of salary and a childcare system where families pay no more than 5% of household income. And the quality is really high and everybody can access it.
Wow. Those are two massive, massive ambitions. Who knew that watching Dion Dublin would lead to the revolution that is Pregnant Then Screwed? But I am so glad that you did, Jolie, because you genuinely have an impact well beyond what I think even you realise. And we need you. We need you to keep fighting that fight. So thank you so much for coming on the Mummifesto today and talking about it and what you're doing. We will share the links of how people can get involved in Pregnant and Screwed and help you. I won't share the links to Homans Under the Hammer because we've all watched it. I'm a bigger fan of Doctors, to be honest, and they're cancelling that. But thank you so much, Jolie, for being with us today.
Thank you, Stella. Who knew you knew so much about daytime TV as well?
You should be on a pub quiz team with me. As long as I get to hold the pen, we're going to win.
I am in. Count me in. Thanks, Stella.
I hope you've enjoyed the Mummifesto this week and listening to all the incredible things that Jolie and the team at Pregnant and Screwed are working on. Frankly, if we could bottle Jolie, the workplace would be a much better place for lots and lots of people. Although I'm still not sure about watching Homes Under the Hammer. Hope you've enjoyed the Mummifesto. Please do listen to the next episode.